Hi, I'm Grant Wall, and welcome to the Planet Football Podcast World Cup Daily. Day 19 of World Cup 2018 is done. Brian Strauss and I will be talking about that as part of our podcast, coming to you daily from Russia through July 16th. Just a small request, it would be a huge help if you subscribe, rate, and review our podcast. It helps people find us. In this episode, I'm also joined by Ed Mallion, the sports editor of The Independent in the UK, about England-Colombia, and since he has worked in Argentina and Spain, his thoughts on those two countries' World Cup exits. Onward! Let's bring in Brian Strauss from his Moscow lair. I am once again at the Fox studio. Brian, how are you, man?
I've been in my lair all day. All day! Wearing the same shirt I slept in.
Oh, great, man. You can do laundry, you know.
I had some laundry done, but and now, you know what? When I had the laundry done, I sent it out to have it done because I'm living that life. And they returned it with each individual article of clothing like vacuum sealed in a plastic bag. Each shirt and each short separately vacuum sealed. I would have been fine just in a big bucket, like a cardboard box.
They do good work here.
They do.
You know, lots to talk about tonight. For me, the single best half of the tournament between Belgium and Japan, 3-2 Belgium.
Better than Argentina, France?
Wow.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so. I'm certainly willing to hear your argument on the other side.
I'm good with it. Go for it.
I just felt like it wasn't just that Japan went up 2-0 in the second half on Belgium. It was that the two Japanese goals were so well taken and just electrifying and stunning and reminded me once again not to assume anything heading into any game at this World Cup. But the way Belgium responded was remarkable. And the changes that Martinez made were really smart.
Yeah, both subs scored, yeah.
You know, Fellaini comes on and clearly takes advantage of his height advantage over the Japanese on his goal. Chadli scores the game winner after coming on as a sub for Carrasco. And we got a chance to see what Belgium might really be about and what might be different about this Belgium team compared to previous Belgium teams, which is a real we're not going to fold mentality in the face of a tremendous challenge. And a lot of teams, I think, wouldn't have responded very well. We saw Spain not respond well. We saw Argentina not respond well in this tournament. And Japan was terrific. And they just conceded 3. And here is Belgium advancing to a quarterfinal against Brazil.
The winning goal, I had a deja vu sort of, I don't know, sensation. As soon as Courtois sort of grabbed the ball and looked up, I saw Timmy Howard against Algeria.
Yeah.
It was the same thing. It was the smile. I mean, obviously, the throws to different places, but something about the throw, something about De Bruyne on the run, Landon on the run. I knew that was going in, you know, like just the way Japan was slow to react to that counter and the kind of space that De Bruyne had in front of him and the commitment that he had to impose himself on that space and take it, you know. I knew that was a goal. Like you just like it at midfield, this is a goal. But Lukaku's dummy was pretty sweet too. Obviously, that was not analogous to Landon's because with Landon's the ball kind of popped out. But I still had that same feeling that I did that day in Pretoria watching that play unfold. It was a wonderful finish, and the fact that it was essentially the last kick of the game too was just super dramatic. Maybe I'm biased against the big teams or for the big teams. Sorry, I'm still going to carry the memory of that second half between France and Argentina, I think, with me a bit longer, and the, you know, the passing of the torch from Messi to Mbappe. But today was pretty awesome too.
Yeah, I just thought it was fantastic. I mean, the record's going to show that Romelu Lukaku did not score in this game and missed multiple chances,
a couple of headers, yeah,
where you were like, how did he miss that? And yet that dummy at speed at that moment of the game in that situation, that's crazy.
Yeah, just crazy. It's just the level of mental, because at that point of the game, you're tired too, right? You're mentally fatigued and maybe you're frustrated because you haven't scored when you should have. And to have sort of the presence of mind and the soccer smarts to make that play there, and obviously the confidence that Chadley's going to get there, very, very, very impressive. So overall, they deserve to win, I think, even though Japan made them work for every inch of it. And I agree, that was a statement that Belgium showed that they can take a punch in the mouth and not fall apart. You know, there wasn't infighting, there wasn't doubt. Well, if there was, we didn't see it or hear it. And obviously a much, much, much tougher test coming up. But this side of the bracket's shaping up to be everything we hoped and feared it would be. I mean, it's four teams that could win the whole thing in two quarterfinals.
Yeah. And the more I think about it, you can imagine if you put yourself in Lukaku's shoes, in his mind, how badly he wanted to score a goal in that situation after the misses he had had. And he would have been a goat, a bad kind of goat, in this game had Belgium gone home for all the chances that he missed, and yet he still was willing to give up the opportunity for a better opportunity by his teammate.
Yeah, so, yeah, just a play of incredible mental fortitude and fitness for him to make there.
Yeah. Let's talk about Brazil-Mexico. Brazil 2, Mexico 0. Mexico goes out for the 7th straight World Cup in the round
of
16.
That's amazing. Just incredible.
And I mean, it's interesting because Mexico started this game pretty well, I thought, mm-hmm. and actually had the advantage for, what, the first 30 minutes of the first half? Certainly seemed that way. And they just didn't have enough quality in the final third, in the way that Brazil ended up having through mainly Willian and Neymar in this game.
It reminded me of their game against Germany. And after that game, there was sort of the, I don't know, like the consensus that, look, you know, we're not going to nitpick Mexico for beating the world champions in their World Cup opener. But there were several moments in that game. Mexico was so devastating on the counter. Germany was so clueless in how to blunt it that Mexico could have easily had two or three more goals. And because of some, I don't know, just poor decisions, nerves, you know, a heavy touch, the precision that they lacked in that game against Germany meant the score was much tighter than maybe it should have been. And today it killed them. Today it was some of the same kind of stuff, and just kind of scratching your head, like, how could they not get a better chance off this? And then you know, Brazil grows into the game. Chicharito clearly is struggling. Neymar to start and finish that first goal was just glorious. I mean, the way he pulled Mexico up. We talked the other day about making a defense move sideline to sideline. Oh my God! Like, the entire Mexican, you know, back six was pulled one way and then sent the other by that heel pass to Willian, and that was just a gorgeous, gorgeous play. And then the doubt creeps in, right? And that was it. That was the game, I think, right there.
Yeah, I know Mexico fans will be frustrated at going out at this stage once again. You know, I just go back. I think the game that's going to be remembered most is the Sweden game. All you need is a tie, and you win the group, and you get Switzerland and an easier side of the bracket, and the potential to go very, very deep in the tournament. And instead, you get Brazil. And I was a little disappointed in Juan Carlos Osorio, who I think overall has done a pretty good job with the Mexican team, and in my opinion, should be a candidate for the U.S. job. I was disappointed that after the game, all he wanted to talk about was referees, when he probably should have just said, look, Brazil was better than us today when it mattered.
What do we think about Neymar?
Well, I mean, he was good today. Yes, he's embellishing quite a bit, and it's possible to say both that I think Miguel Layún knew exactly what he was doing when he stepped on him, because I think that is the case. But it's also possible to say that Neymar made a meal of that in a comical way, actually, that will probably survive on the internet for a very long time.
Oh, I was at the game. What game was I at yesterday? Oh, yeah, Russia-Spain. At the Russia-Spain game, we were watching some of the videos that people have already been making of, like, you know, Neymar rolling down the side of a mountain and starting an avalanche and, you know, that kind of stuff. People are very good. I don't know how you make those fancy moving pictures, but those are pretty awesome. I really wish that I could. The timing on that, when I spent that day with Neymar in Los Angeles, the timing of that in hindsight was so crappy, because it was before he got PSG in his brain. You know, back then he was sort of, you know, he was still part of this wonderful attacking trio at Barcelona that was, you know, team first and, you know, not worried about self-aggrandizement, the spotlight and the Ballon d'Or and all that shit. And then everything sort of changed for Neymar. And then he goes to PSG because he wants it to be his team and he wants to be the man. He, you know, makes the coach cut his birthday cake, and now he's rolling around flailing about like he's on fire. And it just seems like a completely different dude now than he was, you know, a year and a half ago. And I kind of want to interview this Neymar more, you know, and say, what the hell's going on with you, man?
I find it hilarious, actually, that Neymar was part of this three-man front line at Barcelona with Lionel Messi and Luis Suarez that was very effective, but he wanted to go someplace where he'd be the man, and he went to a place that has Kylian Mbappe and Enzo Cavani.
Yeah, what a World Cup PSG's having. Yeah, holy crap. Anyway, like, none of this stuff, like none of this stuff had happened yet, right? When I interviewed Neymar, like, he hadn't done any of this shit yet, so... So we couldn't talk about it because it didn't exist.
Right.
And now he was going on and on about, he's a big NBA fan, and he was going on and on about the Warriors, right? And uh-huh. and Kevin Durant going to the Warriors, and it not being about, you know, it being about, you know, people taking pay cuts for the good of the team and blending all this talent and all this personality. And I'm like, dude, like, stop rolling around. Stop. The only argument for the flailing is, you know, if he's thinking in his head, this is going to get VAR on the case, right? I mean, maybe that's, now are the theatrics not only for the referee, but the theatrics are maybe for the guy in the booth, who's probably Geiger.
Geiger's been assigned every game as the
everywhere. I'm surprised he's not, like, working the front desk of my hotel. The guy's everywhere. So maybe you're doing, maybe that's one of the unintended consequences of, should we say VAR or VAR? What do I say?
Good question. I have toggled back and forth throughout this tournament between VAR and VAR.
What are they saying on the Fox? What are the professional TV types saying?
The professionals as opposed to us amateurs?
Yeah, neither of us are full-time TV dudes. You're a part-time TV dude, and I'm a no-time TV dude.
I have heard both. I actually tend to prefer efficiency, and I would prefer one syllable over three.
Okay. All right. So then this is... perhaps one of the unintended consequences of VAR is that there's going to be more, like, just dumbass stupidity and you know, overreaction.
But I would argue that if you know VAR is there, you shouldn't need to do as much of that crap because they're reviewing it. And I would also argue, if you remember that play in the box against Costa Rica late in the game where Neymar totally embellished when there was a little bit of contact and just
little arm to the chest,
and
right?
And totally flings himself onto the floor. And
catapulted.
And I actually am half convinced that if he had just sort of fallen, he might have gotten the penalty.
But would we have seen the Lyon's? It wasn't even really a stamp, right? It was kind of like he just kind of like casually pressed his cleats at Neymar's ankle. You know, like, would we have even seen that? If Neymar hadn't started, like, I don't know, like crabbing around like he was on a hot stove, you know, I don't know. I don't mean to be making excuses for him because he was brilliant today.
Yeah.
Again, the orchestration on the first goal, and then obviously he continues the run around, which is really, really smart, and makes the finish. And then, you know, the second goal, just the explosiveness and to pull away. And yeah, he's probably shooting on that, but whatever. I mean, he still created it. He was really, really good. But he also is going to clearly do everything he can possibly do to get in everybody's heads, to get under everybody's skin. He's just going to play the heel. He's going to be the guy who, you know, is just kind of always in your face and kind of obnoxious, and he's kind of trash talky, and I guess that's just going to be the guy he is now. And I'm kind of bummed that, like I said, that guy wasn't as pronounced when we sat down with him and had him play Chariots of Fire on the piano, whenever the hell that was. Feels like 5 years ago.
I want to throw out a couple of ideas here. One, I hope somebody on the internet puts the whole writhing post-Layoun stamp action by Neymar in something like The Exorcist, where, you know, like Linda Blair's head was turning around 360 right. degrees, because it was that kind of a like
green projectile vomiting.
Yeah, ensues. Because I mean, yeah. like it was that type of spirits have entered him moment. And then also, apropos of nothing, I thought of this the other night and forgot to mention it on Pavard, the French guy's goal. I'm now going to call him Inspector Pavard, just because I think that he's got a great name to be called, Inspector Pavard.
It's a very good French name.
Yes.
So I got Colombia, England tomorrow. So, you know, I'm starting to see some, like maybe English fans and writers are being ironic when they watch favorites drop like flies, and they start to, you can sense like genuine optimism creeping in and some football's coming home references. And I'm wondering, what are you? You're still joking, right? Tell me you're still joking. But I will be at Colombia, England, obviously hoping that Hamas is able to go. If something has been announced regarding that, I missed it because I didn't put on clothes today. And I've been trying to figure out, for those listeners who want to get behind the World Cup curtain a bit, my reservation at my Moscow hotel ends after the round of 16, and I kind of neglected to make another one after that. So I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do next in terms of where I'll be covering the rest of the tournament. So that's what I've been up to.
So if there's anyone out there in Moscow, or for that matter, any other Russian city that wants to take Brian in on your couch or floor, please feel free.
If you have if you've got extra space in your gulag, please, you know where to find me.
All right, man. Good talking to you. Let's do it again tomorrow.
Talk to you then.
Big thanks to Brian Strauss. Next up is my interview with Ed Mallion. Let's bring our interview guest for today. It's Ed Mallion. He is the sports editor of The Independent in England. And it's one of those situations where you feel like you know somebody even though you've never met them in person, thanks to social media. Got to know Ed, no in quotes, I guess, over quite a bit of time, but it's great to meet you in person finally.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me on. And also, thank you for lunch.
Yeah, really enjoyed it. And let's talk about the World Cup. There's a lot of different things. I want to talk about England. You're from England, but not just about that, because you have lived in Spain. You lived in South America, in Argentina. But let's start with England.
Okay.
England-Colombia. Interesting game. Seems like an opportunity now for England to potentially go really deep in this tournament.
Yeah, I mean, if you follow any English people on social media, you may be aware that it is coming home, as they're keen to remind you. I think this England team has recaptured the imagination of the country a bit, because they're quite likable. Mm-hmm. And I think we've had more talented teams in previous tournaments, but nowhere near as likable or as easy to root for mm-hmm. as this team. Gareth Southgate kind of, you know, he has the feel of, you know, he was the backup guy. He wasn't the guy they wanted. They hired Sam Allardyce, who was then ousted after what you could call an investigation by a newspaper, I guess. And you know, Southgate wasn't the guy. But in the end, he was a safe pair of hands that they went with after a bit of a crisis. He's brought in a lot of the young players he worked with as under 21 coach. He's found a style of play that I think this is his greatest thing. Is he found a style of play that will work against the bad teams and the good teams.
Hmm.
And that's what the World Cup's about, because you're going to have games against the Tunisias, and you're going to have games against the Belgians.
Right.
And you're going to have games, hopefully, against the Brazils, you know, at some point. And I think Southgate has caught the balance just right. I think because of his experiences as a player, like he's had some tough tournament experiences. He missed the penalty that meant England lost the semi-final of Euro 96. He went to World Cup 2002 and didn't play a minute. And all of these have fed into his learning experience. And I think England are coming out the other end stronger because of he's a very rounded guy with a lot of experiences that are giving England a better chance to succeed. And then if they get a bit of luck along the way with an easier draw, then you know, who's to say it isn't coming home?
Yeah, I mean, Spain was viewed as the powerhouse on that side of the bracket, the weaker side. Spain is out. Still, Colombia is going to be a difficult opponent. The big question going in for a lot of folks is James Rodriguez healthy?
I fear he's not. And I say I fear because I think everyone would want him to be on the field if possible. With James playing, England versus Colombia is a 50-50 game for me, and it's a really good, interesting game of football. I love the development of this Colombia team. I got to cover a few of their games at the 2014 World Cup. I was in Belo Horizonte for their first game at World Cup since 1998, and about 100,000 Colombians drove across because it was election weekend in Colombia. And on election weekend, you're not allowed to sell alcohol.
Huh.
So everyone was like, screw that. I'm driving to Brazil. I'm going to watch this game. I'm going to watch Colombia in the World Cup again. And it was the streets were yellow with people. It was just an incredible atmosphere against Greece that day. And they kind of captured my heart a little bit. Mm-hmm. I always enjoy watching South American football and love those nations. But they, you know, they've got a great coach in Jose Pekerman, who's a wily old guy, a bit conservative.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that is good because it reins in their natural instinct to be just wild.
Yeah.
James was the revelation of the last World Cup. We've had Juan Fernando Quintero, who has been kind of the revelation of this World Cup.
Yeah.
For them. Great story. I remember seeing him in 2011, and he looked like he was going to be the next big thing, and his career really went off the rails, and 2 years ago nearly retired. And then this has been his redemption. You know, the sky's the limit for someone of his talent, but he just needs to find the right balance. And with him and James in the team fully fit, Colombia are more than a match for England. He'll be visibly not ready to play a game of this quality, and that's why I'm not being a homer. I just think England will have enough.
Okay. Now, what is your story of living in South America?
So I was doing French and Spanish at university. I've always had an interest in languages and traveling and stuff. I ended up in Argentina coaching the national cricket team, which is a peculiar thing, especially
for
you guys, because...
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, cricket, obviously not a huge thing in America, but and it's not a huge thing in Argentina either, but you've got to remember, like, there is a huge... You've been to Buenos Aires yourself. Yeah. You know Buenos Aires well. And what's the saying about people from Buenos Aires are... They're like, it's... French people who sound like Italians who speak Spanish and want to be English, and there is that element that they, despite the things that you'd expect when I moved there, I thought it could be tough to be English there because of the Falklands and all these things. They're Anglophiles. They're mm-hmm. big Anglophiles. There's one brand that all the kids were wearing called Kevingston, which you know kind of sounds like an English word, and they were showing off to me like, "Oh, do you like this shirt? Do you like this Kevingston shirt? Do you have this in London?" I was like, no, I've never seen it before. Like, it's a completely Argentine brand, but by giving it an English name, it lends it some cachet. So there is kind of a part of Argentine society that plays cricket, especially in the bilingual schools. And I just went out there for a year, was coaching cricket, which is like the easiest job in the world, obviously, just throwing a ball around in the sun. And if you like football and you go and live in Argentina, you're going to go and watch a lot of football.
Yeah.
And I was going every weekend. I was going to different teams, going to Racing, to River, to Boca, to Huracan, to San Lorenzo.
Nice.
And it's impossible not to fall in love with it. You know, I think you've seen here that the Argentine fans have been the greatest again. And in Brazil, they were the soundtrack of the entire tournament with Decime Que Se Siente. You know, that song was ringing in my ears for years afterwards. I just fell in love. And following South American football is an engrossing thing because the Copa Libertadores is just so entertaining. It's wild. Yeah. It's what we find with international football. It's not the highest quality in the world. That's the Champions League still, I think we can all agree. But what it is it's exciting, it's engrossing, it's unpredictable. And sport at its heart needs to be entertaining, and it needs to be unpredictable. There needs to be emotion, and there needs to be drama. And South American football has all of those in spades.
So how would you describe the main failings of Argentina here at the World Cup?
The main feelings now is disappointment and hurt. I've written about 2,000 words on this today, which is how they got to this point. And really, it's decades of corruption and mismanagement. It's Julio Grondona, who stole basically tens of millions of dollars, at least, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. We have no clue how much money he took. in that the U.S. Department of Justice case, one person is admitted to channeling $25 million worth of bribes to him, and he only worked with Grondona from 2010 onwards.
Wow.
And that's one guy.
Yeah.
On working on one client. So it does make you wonder how rich this guy was. But that's money that should have gone into the Argentine system. That's money that could be developing young players. They don't have a system for developing young players. The reason that one of the reasons this squad is so frustrated with the Argentine Football Association is because they get kind of dragged around the world on these friendly tours. They've played mm-hmm. friendlies in Melbourne against Brazil, in Australia. They played friendlies in Bangladesh, in India. Before the tournament, they were supposed to play Nicaragua, which got cancelled because of political reasons. They're supposed to play Israel, which got cancelled because the players wouldn't go for political reasons.
Mm-hmm.
These things don't happen if you're in a well-run association that isn't desperate for money. One of the reasons they're desperate for money is because of all the corruption that's gone before. And as I said, like this squad here, of the 20 Argentine players that took to the field for any minutes, I think it was seven of them played in the under-20 World Cup winning squad in 2007. So that's 11 years ago.
Mm.
Argentina have taken part in three under-20 World Cups since. And only two players from those three squads were in this current World Cup squad. So what does that tell you? It tells you that the pipeline dried up and it stopped, and the pipeline's broken. And they do still develop young players. They produce young players of great quality, like Paulo Dybala. But that is an accident. That is because they're from a football-loving country that just happens to have this insane level of talent. But do they develop them? No, they all leave the country as soon as possible. Lionel Messi obviously is the greatest export, and he left the country at 13. Dybala, Icardi, all these guys, you're seeing them leave younger and younger and younger. The domestic football there is in ruin. I think the future is bleak for them because they haven't got Messi to paper over the cracks anymore. And you can read all about it in that piece, but it's a huge issue that is only going to come to the fore now, and I don't know what they're going to look like in 2022.
You've also lived in Spain,
yeah,
and covered the sport there. You've had some pretty good gigs over the years.
Yeah, you know, it's better to be lucky than to be good, and I've been very lucky so far.
Spain is out as well, and I ask myself, it's one of the stranger games I've seen at a World Cup against Russia, where Spain's so dominant in possession but really didn't create many chances at all and set themselves up with their sort of lack of urgency to go down on penalties.
Did you have the feeling that I kind of felt they were caught between two generations? Hierro went with Isco and dropped Iniesta for this game, and it was looking towards kind of, we want Isco to be the star, and I think the Madrid-based press certainly was trying to push Isco as, this is his tournament, he's going to show he's a world-class superstar and all these sorts of things. But that's been a Madrid thing for a while, and we're yet to see consistent greatness from this guy. And we have seen consistent greatness from players like Iniesta.
Right.
I felt that playing him alongside Busquets and Silva meant that they were mixing the two, and the two generations didn't quite mesh. Lopetegui, who was obviously the coach until literally a day before the tournament starts, was the under-21 coach who loved Isco and Thiago and Koke and Saul and this next generation of midfielders. And I think if you were going to try and build the team around Isco, you needed to have the younger core in there who all get it. They all work with each other. They all know. Because this was kind of reminiscent of the 2010 Spain in the way that they kept the ball. It was utter dominance, like 80% possession against the Russians. But what they didn't have was what they call in Spanish the verticality, the drive forward. And in the end, it was almost like a cowardice from Spain. I was incredibly disappointed because, you know, if you're talking like NBA, trust the process, right? And Spain believe in their process, and their process is we will dominate teams in possession. We will pass them to death. And what's going to happen? But the reason for the dominance of possession and the passing it side to side is you wait for a gap to open up, and you drive through it. At some point, you know, it's slow, 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 quick.
Right.
At some point, it's left, 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 right, left, right, left, right, left, right, forward. And they never did the forward thing. They never did the quick thing. It was just slow. It was sterile. And
no one was moving.
No, it was the immobility of it. We were watching it, and it was the 67th minute. If you ever want to go back and watch it, there was a three-minute period where Russia didn't touch the ball, and the ball went side to side from left to right three or four times, and no one moved. You could see the perfect formation, the 4-3-3. It's like, that's great, but there's no spark, there's no creativity. And when you trust the process, you have to trust that you're a dominant team, you're the better team, and to make that count, you have to try and win the game. Because if you're getting all the ball like that, you've probably got a 70 or 80% chance of winning the match, right? Mm. If you let it go to penalties, you've probably got, on technique, a 55 to 45% chance. So you have to win it in those 2 hours. And as the time ticked down and they brought on players who I felt were kind of more out the system, like Aspas and Rodrigo, they looked better. But they left it too late. And I really just don't think they ever cranked it up to 11. They didn't get aggressive enough. They didn't try different things. And in the end, that kind of the cautiousness and the lack of new ideas probably is summed up by the hiring of Hierro to replace Lopetegui, when maybe they could have gone with Saladis or someone else. But ultimately, just such a disappointing tournament for Spain.
Do you think Lopetegui would have coached this game differently than Hierro did?
No doubt. No doubt in my mind. I think pre-tournament, we were saying on our podcast, the Indie Football podcast, that the big thing they're going to lose with Hierro is Hierro is much more conservative than Lopetegui. And Lopetegui is better at the in-game read and the in-game tweaks. They effectively hired a suit. You know, Hierro was the director of football. Mm. If Southgate had quit before the tournament, would England have given Dan Ashworth the job? No, they would have hired a coach underneath Lopetegui, right? And that would have been the natural move for Spain as well, but they didn't. They went from upstairs instead of from downstairs, which I thought was peculiar. Lopetegui, I think, would have made better changes. He had more faith in the youth in that team, and Hierro clearly didn't. Hierro brought on Rodrigo after, I think, 107 minutes. And Rodrigo immediately was far more dangerous than Diego Costa had been in the entire game. So I think it was a loss. I don't think they should have sacked him. I know lots of people disagree, and I can see both sides to that. But I really think, and it'll never get reported this way fully in Madrid because of the way the press works there, but Florentino Perez played a huge part in Spain's downfall this month.
Yeah, and I think it's possible to feel that Real Madrid was not a good actor in this situation, but also Spain didn't need to fire Lopetegui.
I appreciate that. Like, so if Real Madrid had gone through an entire month of this tournament with no coach, like, people would be losing their minds in Spain. Like, that's how it works. So, like, if people don't understand, for people who don't maybe understand the Spanish media, there are four major sports newspapers that go out every day in Spain, which is
that's incredible.
Very unique, isn't it? And there are two in Madrid and two in Barcelona, essentially, and they're very partisan towards the clubs from their city. And they have pages to fill every day. So every single day, you're going to get at least 10 or 11 pages of Real Madrid on like a normal Tuesday at any time of the year. So if Real Madrid did not have a coach, it's not the sort of thing that gets swept under the carpet. Real Madrid don't have a coach for a month, like, people are going to be losing their minds. So they had to hire someone, and Lopetegui was sixth or seventh choice. That's fine. But they offer him the job, and if you look at Lopetegui's record, it's probably the best club job he's ever going to get.
Yeah.
It's the biggest club in the world, probably, if not definitely. He failed at Porto. He has to take this job. The thing that was bad was the communication, and also like this weird kind of, and it's very kind of a Latin instinct is oh no, like, it's an affront to us that he's taken this job a day before the World Cup. It's like, well, no, he still wants to win the World Cup, you know. This doesn't change his motivation to win the World Cup. There would have been obvious issues with perhaps the dynamic with like Real Madrid, Barcelona within the squad, but most of the squad, I've talked to like some of the players in there, most of the squad wanted Lopetegui to stay,
right?
And I think you've got to listen to those guys, not the guys at the top in the suits.
And treat them like pros. They're not babies.
Yeah. And Lopetegui is a professional.
Yeah.
He's a professional who's been responsible for the immense success of the Spanish youth system. And what you've suddenly decided is, despite knowing his character inside out, despite knowing him for a decade or longer, you've suddenly decided he's not a man that we want working for us. He's not a professional who wants the best for us. It's like, why would he not want to win the World Cup? Why would he not want to leave on the best possible note? And I just think, you know, that sacking your coach is going to, on the eve of the tournament, is going to damage your hopes of winning it. And that's what you're here to do.
So, yeah.
You know, it's as simple as that.
Yeah, and it did make a difference in the end, clearly from what we saw on the field. I want to wrap up by talking a little bit about your affinity, quite clearly from our lunch discussion before this, for U.S. sports.
Yeah.
You seem to be very interested in like the NFL and other U.S. sports.
I love the NFL. I think, you know, especially like this last season, really kind of this last season, I felt like I preferred NFL to what you guys would call soccer. And it's just the competitive parity of the league, I think, is such an important thing. I love that you have the finite amount of resources, like the salary cap, and it's how you maximize that. You know, the draft, I get very deep into the draft. Like this year when the Giants took Saquon Barkley at 2, I was just outraged. How on earth, like, how do you take the, you never take a running back second overall. Like, just trade out the pick or just realize that Eli Manning is absolutely spent and just get a new quarterback. What you don't, and like also in the greatest quarterback class probably for years, like there are 5 first round guys here, and you could trade down, get a bucket load of picks to like sort yourself out for years, get Lamar Jackson at the end of the first round, and instead you take a running back who are like on average pay are only above punters and kickers, and you take him second overall, you make him the highest paid running back in the league, like things like that. That's just one example. I just think it's great for London that we're going to get an NFL team in 2022, and I know that's not official, but I've talked to enough people that know stuff that it is going to happen.
Yeah.
And that will be huge for the league, it'll be huge for London. There are still questions, talking to people inside the NFL about it, they've done the research, as you'd expect for a company of that size. There's only one question, is can a team stay competitive in London? Can they attract free agents, I think is the question, because obviously with the draft and trades and stuff, lots of players don't have a say in where they're going to go. But can you attract free agents to London?
I'd rather live in London than Cleveland, by the way.
Yeah, no, I mean, I see that, but you know, you've got a different background to lots of these NFL players. I think that there is, it'll be a huge culture shock for some of these guys. If you grow up, so like for example, you just watch Hard Knocks, right? Like last year's one, the Buccaneers are on it, and you look at where Jameis Winston grew up, and that is thousands of miles, literally, from London, and it's a million miles culturally from London. And I do kind of feel like if you got a rookie maybe who grew up in a tough part of Louisiana or Tennessee, and then he's transplanted to Hampstead in North London, it's like, how's he going to cope?
Because it's an immense
shift.
Yeah.
That's going to be difficult to get over. But I think it'll certainly be great for everyone living in London. It'll be great for the NFL to expand its horizons like that. And you know, I think the more I learn about US sports, you know, I've always enjoyed NHL. I love ice hockey. I think it's actually the most natural fit if you're a football fan, like a soccer fan.
Yeah.
The speed of the game, I think sports are better when it's hard to score, kind of. It's a little theory I have. Baseball I enjoy for the same reason I enjoy cricket. You get to sit around all day drinking.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very fun social sport. Like whenever I'm over with my in-laws, like go and watch the Cubs, who are now good for the first time in like forever, which is great. And you know, every American sport has this sort of cyclical nature because of the salary caps and because of the franchise nature. It's the unpredictability of sport. And this is what we were saying earlier on about the Libertadores in football and whatever is. You want your sport to be dramatic. You want to feel emotion. You want to kind of know that there's hope. Everyone needs hope. And I support a football team, Crystal Palace, who we know what our ceiling is every season. It's like if we had our best season, we could probably finish like 8th in the Premier League.
Yeah.
And if we have a bad season, we're getting relegated. And that's fine, because I've watched us for years in the Championship, and that's great. But modern football in England is getting very, and Europe is getting hyper corporate. You know, the richer are getting richer. It's like society. The rich are getting richer. Right. The elite are just cornering more money for themselves. The Premier League agreed to it a couple of weeks ago, where the bigger clubs are going to get a larger share of international TV revenue. That is not going to stop. You know, they don't decide they have enough money and go like, oh, that'll do. When has a rich person ever said, no, I've got enough money? That, you know, apart from maybe Bill Gates, who's like the one example in the world. And that's happening in sport in Europe, is the biggest football teams are getting richer and richer, and competition is no longer the priority. And when you're embedded in that on a daily basis, like I am, which I'm fortunate and unfortunate at times to be embedded in, American sports for me is like a release. It's like I can watch NFL, and yeah, I know the Jets are going to be terrible, but oh wait, they just got Sam Darnold, and this whole thing can turn around. Like the Bears, so the Bears are my team, and they can win 4 games 1 year, and they get the new coach. Trubisky might pop. You've got what's his name? Allen Robinson's come in. Taylor Gabriel's in there. They got the second round receiver Anthony Miller. Tariq Cohen's like a little live wire. I love watching Jordan Howard. They got Roquan Smith in the first round. So it's like whoa, this could be a team.
Yeah.
And that's one season. It's that one turnaround. And so sometimes you need to have like the hope of something unexpected. And you know, the Eagles winning the Super Bowl is the ultimate proof of that.
Well, just as there are probably more savvy soccer fans now in the U.S. than maybe even people realize, there are more savvy NFL fans in the U.K. than people realize.
Oh, for sure. I mean, Gareth Southgate, a lot's been made of how he's learned from other sports in this tournament, right? But he went over to the Super Bowl in February.
Mm-hmm.
Mark Chapman, who presents the BBC coverage over here, huge NFL fan. There are loads of guys, especially in sports media, I think. It helps if you're a sports fan.
Yeah.
And you just need to have open eyes to these things. But as soon as you kind of really, you get NFL and you watch it, I sent my chief sports writer to one of the NFL games in London, Jonathan Liu, who you must have read his stuff. And
he's
a terrific writer. Like, he's just an incredibly talented writer, but he knows nothing about NFL. I said, look, just go to a game. I talk to the NFL guys. They'll give you all access. You can talk to whoever you want and just write about what you see. And what he wrote was a brilliant piece that looks at the sport from a different angle to anything I've even thought of, about a sport which is about the hyper-specialization of everything. It's, you have defensive backs coaches and running backs coaches, and everyone has their own individual thing, and it's all these guys are the absolute elite athletes in like every position. It's like, right, nose tackle, what do you want? Right, I want 6'7", 300 pounds. Okay, we'll get 6'7", 300 pound guys who can run like a 5 second 40. It's incredible, really. It's like the Transformers brought into sport. And I think when people realize like how interesting some of these US sports are, they're kind of, in the UK especially, we're opening up to it. We've got the TV rights now. You've got the access that we never had before with terrestrial television. Now with satellite and the breadth of coverage and the internet, I guess, that we can read the American coverage. Like, you know, I mainly read American NFL coverage, obviously, because it's better than what we have. There are a lot of savvy fans in the UK who want more, and it's the same in America. There are lots of savvy soccer fans who I feel like they deserve like a really in-depth coverage of the great sport, you know, and they're going to get it increasingly. It feels like the television networks and with the World Cup coming, I guess every digital media out there is going to have to improve their soccer output. And that's only great for the fans, and it's great for people like you as well.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's been fascinating for me to follow, being at Sports Illustrated since 1996, the path that the sport of soccer football has taken in ways that I wouldn't have even necessarily predicted. Didn't necessarily think it was inevitable it would get to this point in the U.S. So with the World Cup coming in 26, I really do think that's an opportunity to take all this growth that we've seen in soccer and actually take it to a new level. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. Where can people find you on social media?
On Twitter at EAA Malyon, M-A-L-Y-O-N. All of our work is at Indie Football and independent.co.uk/football, and it's just it's been a wild World Cup, but the guys are producing some great stuff, and it's hopefully going to get better, you know, especially if England can continue doing what they're doing.
Thanks so much for joining me.
No, thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Planet Football World Cup Daily Podcast. I'd like to thank Brian Strauss and Ed Malyon, as well as everyone at Cadence 13 and Sports Illustrated who supports this podcast. Please, if you like the pod, tell your friends, subscribe, like, and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast. It really does help the cause if you do, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. you get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
If you're a podcast host, listen up, this one's for you. My name is Allie Jackson. I'm the host of Finding Mr. Height, a dating and relationship podcast that I've been doing for 4 years now, sharing my positive and practical approach to dating that's built on my own life experience. And I wanted to share another experience that I've had, my secret behind monetizing my show. It's called Red Circle. And I was just telling my colleague about how much I love their platform. With Red Circle, not only am I getting a seamless hosting experience, but I also love the support I receive in ad sales. It's not just typical ad sales either. It's targeted opportunities based on my show and my life. And the platform is super simple. You just set your preferences and Red Circle matches you with sponsors that align with your show. You can vet every opportunity and their platform gives you great analytics. More recently too, my Red Circle team has brought me opportunities outside of my podcast on social media to really augment the podcast partnerships, bring them full circle. I just can't recommend them enough. If you want to give it a try, go to redcircle.com to get your free trial. That's redcircle.com for a free trial.